The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
I had a friend who told me an interesting story. You know, sometimes the questions are so big that they're almost beyond us comprehending. And you have to be in awe of them. And sometimes they're just the simple details. So I had a friend who tried his hand at making Aliyah. Came to Israel, really knew not a word of Hebrew. And went through a very tough time. And one day they found their apartment was full of cockroaches. Okay? And he didn't know what to do. So he wanted to get an exterminator or some exterminating spray. So a friend said to him, listen, go to, you know, the bottom of Ben Yehuda Street, go to such and such a store, and there you can get, like, good stuff for killing cockroaches. The only problem was he didn't know how to say cockroaches. So the guy said, and he didn't know any Hebrew. So that's a complicated sentence. So the guy said, listen, just go into the store and say, tzarich laharog charakim. Okay, we have to kill bugs. And they'll figure it out. They'll give you a spray against bugs. Okay? So he figures fine. His wife is driving him nuts. He goes in and he finds this store, true story, and he walks in. The only problem is he got the word wrong. He says, Tzarich laharog charidim. Okay? Now the word charidim means ultra-Orthodox Jews. Labels are a little challenging, but for the purpose of this discussion. And the fellow behind the counter, because this was right near Geula, happened to sort of, you know, have a little, you know, white shirt, black beard, sits us down to his knees, and his mouth pops open. He looks at him, and he figures that the guy doesn't hear him. He says, Tzarich la'arog charakim, charidim. We have to kill charidim. So the guy looks at him, and a woman there turns around, and then he says, his friend told him that if they don't get it, so just say to him, it's important. So he says, well, how do I say it's important? He says, just say miyad, immediately. So he looks at them, and he says, Tzarich la'arog charidim miyad. We have to kill charidim immediately. So sometimes it all hinges on the detail. But this was just one example of what this fellow went through when he came to Israel. And we got into this deep discussion because his question was, what am I doing all this for? I mean, is it all worth it? What's the point? Why do we need this? And maybe just to express this on a deeper level, and I'd actually like to dedicate this class, a student who's here who recently lost her father, who asked if we would dedicate this class to Chaim Ben Nachum, right? Should be an Ilui for his neshama. And I'd also like to say that with all the struggles that we're having in Israel today, we should broaden the picture. And I have in mind, God willing, that that the learning we do and the prayer that we do this weekend, that should be in the merit of all the people, not just in Israel, but all over the world, and specifically in America, who are struggling with homelessness and all sorts of other challenges. But in 1947, a group of five got together in a prison, a British prison, in the Russian compound, for a very special Pesach Seder. The reason it was a special Pesach Seder was because, on the one hand, this was actually the last Pesach that the Jewish people would be without a Jewish homeland after 2,000 years. Only they didn't know it. The Jews in Israel have been struggling for a state for quite a while, certainly with great gusto in the last 10 years, since the Holocaust began. Those of you who know the historical background, the British were not exactly open-minded about letting the Jews in. And these particular five individuals, amongst them Barazani, Al-Kahi, and most famous amongst them was Dov Gruner, had actually been caught by the British, smuggling guns in operations against the British Army. And they were all wearing the red uniforms of the condemned to death. Three of them were already supposed to be shipped to Akko. All five of them were actually hanged by the British just before the State of Israel was declared. There was actually a special last-minute attempt to gain a pardon for them. Rabbi Aryeh Levine was approached on Friday night to try to get to the British High Commissioner to beg for a stay of the execution. And he actually got in a taxi on Shabbos, and anybody who knows who Rabbi Levine was, knows just what a challenge that must have been for him, got in a taxi on Shabbat to go to the British High Commissioner to try to gain a pardon. which was not received. And Dov Gruner understood that the writing was on the wall. And he wrote a last letter just before he was executed to his commander, Menachem Begin. And it reads, I write these lines a few hours before the enemy is about to murder me on the gallows. In such an hour, a person does not lie. Dov Gruner had been a faithful soldier of Menachem Begin, the Lehi, and Gun. And you kind of ask yourself in those last moments, is it worth it? Did you choose the right path? I swear to you that if I had the possibility of starting over, I would choose exactly the same path without thought for the possible consequences. Your faithful soldier, Dov Gruner. I want you to, the first time I read this letter, I sat, I think, for hours trying to figure out what to do with this. Is it worth it? Why do we need it? In 1973, in the Yom Kippur War, 2,000 Syrian tanks crossed the border in the Golan Heights. There were barely 150 tanks to stand against them. There was only one battalion, the 77th of Kailani, whose tanks were literally ready and fully prepared. Between the campaign in the north and the campaign in the Sinai, 1,800 boys came home in body bags. Is it worth it? Could anything be worth that? One of the big discussions that's going on today in Israel is land. Land for peace, land for land, just land. Some call it the question of sacred space. Some view it as the ultimate goal. Some consider it the ultimate problem. Does it matter where you are? I mean, isn't what's important who you are? 100 years ago, the first Zionist Congress had an interesting dilemma. They debated whether or not they were made an offer by the British Commonwealth to be given a Jewish state in Uganda. There were, by the way, if I'm not mistaken, 11 different propositions, 7 of them taken very seriously. One of them, by the way, was in Grant Island, which is in America. It's not far from Niagara Falls. In fact, two of my children were in a Bnei Akiva camp, which was in whatever the northwestern corner of Pennsylvania, and they took a trip to Niagara Falls, and in order to make it an educational experience, they decided to stop at Grant Island. And to tell them the story of Grant Island, a group of wealthy Jews had actually purchased this land and presented to Congress the possibility of creating a separate territory for the Jews, and this would be the Jewish state. Okay, be no problem with American citizens, Americans supporting Israel. We would be the 51st state of America. And there were actually those who took it very seriously, and it came to the Zionist Congress for a vote. And I remember my daughter's response. She was, I don't know, 8 or 9 at the time. And they took them on this whole thing, and they sat them down, and they asked them, maybe we should have had the state of Israel here. They had to picture the scene of the Niagara River and all these roaring waters, you know, passing by this island. And my daughter's response was, well, if we had made the state of Israel here, we wouldn't have any water problems. And it kind of makes you wonder. I mean, we assume that, thank God, wisdom prevailed and the state of Israel was declared, and the Zionist Congress, by the way, by a very narrow margin, voted that the only true homeland for the Jewish people is in the land of Israel. Theodor Herzl, by the way, voted for a state in Uganda. Because to Theodor Herzl, what's the difference? It's not where we are, it's who we are. And that's a Jewish value. And by the way, just so we don't sit so confidently, maybe even arrogantly, with our prescient hindsight, if Theodor Herzl would have won the day and a Jewish state would have been declared in Uganda, we might not have lost 6 million Jews 60 years ago. So this is not a simple question. But it begs at least the question, why do we need Israel? What is Israel? What is this idea that we struggle with, that people are willing to die for, that seems to occupy so much time in the world media? Is it real? Is there a need for it? And I guess the first question is, where did this all begin? Where did this start? This whole notion. So, I want to tell you an interesting thing. If If you had to ask yourselves, and most people here I imagine know the answer, who started the journey, who began sort of our journey to Israel, and why? Probably most of you had to come up with a single name, that first individual who came to Israel, who started the journey, and our relationship with the land of Israel, it would be Avraham. Okay, Abraham. And Avraham goes to the land of Israel because God tells him, Lech lecha me'artzecha mimoladetecha mibeit avicha. Go from your homeland, from your land, mimoladetecha, your moledet, the place that you were born, right? Your neighborhood, beit avicha, the house of your father. And there are all sorts of questions why there seem to be three separate departures. Go from your land, and go from your homeland, and go from your father's house. And it's a whole discussion, the commentators discuss. Ela aretz asher areka, to the land that I will show you. God doesn't even tell him exactly where that land is. He just says, the land that I will show you. It's a very strange verse. Why doesn't God just say, listen, here are the coordinates. Take a due easterly heading. Walk for about 11 days. And, you know, when you're there, I'll just blink a few stars. No, the land that I will show you. Ooh, what does that mean? And you would assume that Abraham was the one who began that relationship, and you would probably be right. And I'm going to tell you that you're right, and that that's the answer, and that's what everybody says, in order that you don't misunderstand me when I now tell you that that's wrong. It's not that that's wrong, that is right, but having said that that's right, now I have to show you why that's wrong. Because in fact, Avraham does not begin the journey to the land of Israel. There's a very, very strange verse, okay, that appears literally, you know, the Jewish people's story really begins with the portion of Lech Lecha. That's the portion in the Torah that details Avraham's mission, his journey, etc. Right? But, and the portion of Noach. The portion of Noach really deals with the world. And the portion of Noach actually begins with a magical experience. I mean, a family is saved after a flood, the ultimate Holocaust, and they have the chance to begin again. The whole world is about to begin again. For a second time, everyone in the world is going to be descended of one family. Very deep idea. We're all cousins. We could really, if we really wanted to, find ways to let go of our differences. Okay. And for whatever the reasons, that doesn't work. And Avraham comes on the scene. But just before Avraham comes on the scene as sort of that charismatic force that bursts on the world stage, his father, Terach. Now Terach, by the way, is an idolater. He's not exactly up there in the who's who of Jewish history. But he's still the father of Avraham. Must have done something right. We know very little about Terach from the Torah itself. In fact, the Torah really only tells us one detail. What is the detail about Terach that's important for us to know? Vayikach Terach et Avram beno. Terach takes, this is the last verses of the portion of Noach, so it's very easy to find. Terach takes Avram his son, that Lot ben Haran ben beno, and Lot and Sarai his daughter-in-law. Vayetzu itam me'ur kasdim. And he leaves from a place known as Ur Kasdim, which is also Haran. Sorry, from which is in Babylon. Lalechet arza Canaan, to journey towards Canaan. And they come to Haran, Mesopotamia, and that's where they end up settling. Think about it. Terach starts the journey to Canaan. Canaan is the land of Israel. Now the Torah doesn't tell us why he goes. Doesn't tell us what the purpose of it. There's no description of a mission. God doesn't tell Terach to go. He just goes. It really could have told me that Terach leaves Ur Kasdim, the land of that would later become known as Babylon, and heads towards Haran, where he settles. It doesn't say that. It says he heads towards Canaan, but he gets sidetracked, he ends up in Haran. In other words, it seems that what's less important is where he ends up than where he wants to be. He sets out to go to Canaan. He begins the journey. So Avram is really continuing a journey that his father began. Only in Avram's case, God is stepping in to get it finished. And by the way, even that is not entirely correct. Because how does Terach end up in Ur Kasdim? This is fascinating. If you look a little bit earlier, right, sort of just after the story of the flood, there's a very strange story. Anybody remember the strange story after the flood, before the birth of the Jewish people? Anybody? No? Nope. That's the story of Noach. When we're finished with Noach, the flood is... Pardon? The Tower of Babel. Migdal Babel. Tower of Babel. It's not accidental that Babylon is called Babel, because the result of this story is that everybody doesn't understand each other and it's all Babel. So we'll call it the Tower of Babel. Okay? It's a very strange story. Everybody goes together. They end up in a valley. They start building things. God's upset with what they're building. Checks it out. Doesn't like it. So everybody starts speaking a different language and they all go their separate ways. And now we bring you back to our story of Abraham. What is that doing there? It's a very strange story. What's fascinating about this story, first of all, is how it begins. Remember, the ark lands, according to the Torah, on the mountain of Ararat. The hills of Ararat, which is somewhere in Turkey. And every now and then you read some interesting Life magazine or Time magazine story about some archaeologist who's out in the mountains of Ararat looking for the ark. Okay, it's interesting. Somewhere out there, when you really think about it, civilization was reborn. Noach and his family are in an ark, if you accept the Torah's story, which I do, right? It's interesting, by the way, there was a study, I believe it was from Johns Hopkins University, but I could be wrong. They were studying cultural similarities, and they discovered that the flood story appears in the legends of over 120 different cultures in the world, right? Fascinating. There is some basis, some common thread that there was some flood. What you do with that is up to you. So they start. Civilization is about to begin again. Now, they can't live up on top of the mountains of Ararat. That's just not where you want to be. And Noach, by the way, according to Jewish tradition, is a farmer. In fact, according to Rashi and according to biblical legend, the Medrash, rabbinic legend, Noach actually has a small claim to fame in that he invented the plow. Whether he literally invented the plow or whether this has to do with who Noach was and what the plow represents is a discussion for another time. But Noach's a farmer. This becomes very clear because the first thing he does is to plant the vineyard. So if you're a farmer, you don't want to stay up in the mountains. So where does civilization go? Listen to this. Vayhi kol ha'aretz safa achat. And the whole land was one language. Now that's a funny verse. Because the whole land is Noach and his three sons and their wives and whatever. So there are two opinions. One opinion is, well, some time has passed. There are, after all, 10 generations from Noach until Abraham. And so now there's a lot of people, but they still all speak the same language. Right? The other opinion is, no, this is talking about Noach and his family, but it dawns upon them at this moment that they are the whole land. They're the whole world. That's an awesome responsibility. What we do will determine where the world goes. So now they have to decide where they're going to make camp. Where's the world going to begin? Vayehi ben nas'am mikedem. And it was when they traveled from the east. Now, if you know anything about the maps, geography, if they're traveling from the east and heading westwards, where are they heading to? They're heading towards Israel. And that's what the Medrash, rabbinic legend, is full of. They're heading towards the land of Canaan. And then you start to see these rabbinic legends. You know, Adam offered up his sacrifice on Mount Moriah, where the temple would one day be built. And Cain and Abel fought on Mount Moriah. There seems to be some sense that that's where we have to go. In fact, the most fascinating piece of this, interestingly enough, is the mystical tradition, and I'm not a mystic, but the mystical tradition, you know, if you've never been to Israel, so you have to come, shame on you, we look forward to welcoming you. It doesn't matter to me how you come, who you come with, right? But when you get to Israel, notice I don't say if, and you come to the Old City, because if you go to Israel, you're going to get to the Old City. So you just ask around for Israelites, and you come check out our rooftop. And we stand on the rooftop of Israelite. There's this incredible view, right? And it doesn't matter if we're there or not. Just let us know. We'll make sure the door's open. You can walk up to the roof. And you can see the Mount of Olives, and you can see the Judean Desert. On a clear day, you can see all the way to Jordan. It's an unbelievable view. And you see the Temple Mount. And it kind of hits you. It's interesting. You know, people make a mistake. They think that that gold dome is a mosque. The gold dome is not a mosque. In fact, the gold dome, which is called the Dome of the Rock, is called the Dome of the Rock because it was built sitting on top of a very special rock. Right? The Muslims believe that this is where Burak, the horse of Muhammad, when he was on his way up to heaven, kind of took a leap out of the desert of Saudi Arabia, landed in Israel, in Jerusalem, on that rock, left his footprint, and then flew up to heaven. What you do with that legend's up to you. Doesn't matter to me whether it is or it isn't, like any other legend. By the way, just as an aside, don't ever make the mistake of saying, you know, how absurd, you know, I don't know, Christians are for believing in a virgin birth, or Muslims are for believing in journeys to heaven, because we believe that Moses started his journey talking to a burning bush, right? Everybody has their perception. But it's almost as though, even among the Arab world, there's a sense that this place is somehow close to heaven. You need to land here to get to heaven. The Jews believe that that Evan, that stone, is called the Evan Shetiyah or the Evan Yetzirah, the place from which the world was formed. And whether you accept that or you don't, whether you believe in that literally or allegorically, Yerushalayim, which is the holy center of Israel, which itself is the center from the Jewish perspective of the world, is all predicated on the fact that that's where it all began. And so the Midrashim here, and if we had 3 hours we could go into this, rabbinic legend seems to suggest that civilization understood that they needed to get back to where it all began. Why? They seem to be on a journey to Israel. Why? And by the way, if you look at it this way, then the beginning of civilization leaves the mountains of Ararat, and then they land in Ur Kasdim in Bavel. Terach then takes his family from Ur Kasdim, but he ends up in Haran, and then Abraham leaves Haran, finally arriving in the land of Israel. Hence the verse, Rav Avigdor Nevenzahl suggests, hence the verse, right? Lech lecha me'artzecha, mimoladetecha ve'beit avicha, leave your land and your birthplace and the house of your father, is really parallel to those three journeys. The journey that began with the children of Noach, leaving the mountains of Ararat, the journey that continued from Ur Kasdim with your father, landing in Haran, and the journey that you now undertake from Haran to get to the land of Israel. And it's very interesting, if that's so, that Avraham's journey doesn't begin in Haran. Avraham's journey is just a continuation. Part of our question is not where I'm going, but am I part of a bigger journey? Can I tap into that bigger journey? And there's a very interesting detail, by the way, in this story of the Tower of Babel, which suggests that there's something deeper going on here. Vayomru, and these people say, when they get to this, right? Benusami Kedem, they leave the east. Vayimtzu Vik'ah, and they find a valley. Be'eretz Shinar, Vayeshvu Sham, and they dwell there. Vayomru Yishal Re'eu, and they say, let's make bricks. Hava Nivne Lanu Iru Migdal, and let's build a city and a tower. Ir Umigdal, a city and a tower. Vayered Hashem Lirot Et Ha'ir Ve'et Ha'Migdal, and so God comes to see, what that means is, again, for another time, but God comes to see the city and the tower. And God says, Hein am echad v'safa achat l'kulam, v'zeh achilom la'asot. They have one language, and this is what they want to do. It's a very strange line. What's so bad? They want to build a tower. Walk through Manhattan. Lots of people want to build towers. What got God so upset about this one? And what does it have to do with they all speak the same language? I would think it's because they all speak the same language that they can build the tower. Right? Because if we're trying to build an apartment, and I say to you, tavi, 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 maya, and you say to me, ¿qué pasa? So we can't build a tower. But we all speak the same language, we can build anything. Maybe that's the challenge of the world. Can we get back to learning how to speak each other's language? But something bothers God here. So, God comes down. Lo yibatzer lehem asher yazmu, and what they plotted to do will not occur. Navlasam sfatam, we're going to mix up their languages. Fayafetz Hashem otam misham, and Hashem separates them from there. Al pnei kol haaretz, throughout the land, which means the world. Vayachdelu livnot ha'ir, and they stop building the city. Now isn't that interesting? It doesn't say they stop building the tower. It says vayachdelu livnot ha'ir, they stop building the city. We call this story the Tower of Babel. But the Torah implies the real issue was the city. It begins with the fact that they stop and they want to build a city. And again, the rabbis suggest this was their big mistake. What's so terrible about building a city? It can't be that objectively cities shouldn't be built. The place that we all face when we pray, in any place in the world that we pray from, is Ir David, the city of David. A city can be a majestic thing. The problem seems to be that they wanted to build the city there because they were on a journey. And they instinctively understood that they were headed somewhere. And for whatever the reason, because the valley looked too good, they stopped. And somehow Terach, and maybe this is why Terach merits to have an Avraham, Terach understands, we need to leave this place. We're in the valley. You know, when you're in the valley, the land is very fertile. But you can't see where you are. You can't start a journey from a valley. It's very difficult. You have to go up on the mountaintop and see where you're headed. So they need to continue the journey. What is this sets? And maybe, and again, I wish we had 3 hours, but for the purpose of discussion, maybe the reason that this journey was so valuable was precisely because they all spoke the same language. You see, speaking the same language, that's not a coincidence. That's not a happenstance. That's the essence of who they were and where they were meant to go. The gift of oneness, the gift of unity, the gift of achdut, of being together, that carries with it an awesome responsibility. Because what we can accomplish in this world when we're one is unbelievable. So if God blesses them after a world of chaos that was filled with violence, you know, Rashi here says a fascinating thing. Rashi, the commentary on the Torah, says, "V'cheizo kasher," this is difficult, "shel dor ha'mabul or shel dor ha'aflaga." Which is worse, the generation of the flood or the generation of the Tower of Babel, right? "Elu lo pashtu yad bi'ikar li'lachem bo." You know, the people of the flood, they never rebelled against God. The general consensus among Jewish tradition is that they were building a tower to take God's place. We will be the center of the world. So they rebelled against God. Can't do anything worse than that. Ve'elu pashtu yad bi'ikar li'lachem bo. And these of the Tower of Babel, they chose to do battle with God. As ridiculous as that may sound to us. Ve'elu nishtafu, ve'elu lo nevdu min ha'olam. And here are these people from the generation of the flood who didn't actually rebel against God. They were swept away in the flood, and these who rebelled against God, they were just separated. Listen to what Rashi says. Ela shador mabul hayu gazlanim v'yaitam meriva b'nihem. They were robbers in the generation of the flood. And their lives were full of conflict. They couldn't get along. Lekach nevdu, and therefore they were destroyed. Ve'elu hayu noagim v'rayut b'nihem. She'ne'emar safa achat. Udvarim achadim. And this generation, even though they rebelled against God, they got along with each other. They could work together. They could build together. Lamata shesanuya machloket v'gadol ha'shalom. And thus you have learned, says Rashi, how detested is strife and argument, and how beloved is peace. You see, if there was a time when an entire world spoke the same language, when an entire world could be on the same journey, then the implications, the possibilities of what that generation could have done were unlimited. And the fact that they could have gone back to Israel was so important that the very fact that they chose to stop that journey was their undoing. Which returns us to the question, so what was so important about the land of Israel? And it seems, and now we get into the world of conjecture, it seems that the most critical point about the land of Israel is that the land of Israel is where it all began. So that's point number one. Somehow, Israel represents the challenge, the mission, the ability to get back to where it all began. So put that thought in one side of your heads, okay? And let me share with you a second idea. Right? You know, this week, it was a very, very difficult week. I don't know if some of you got the email, but just on Thursday, we buried 15 of those who fell in Gush Katif, in Gaza, over the last 30 years. And while the world media is preoccupied with, as it should be, with what's going on in the southern part of the United States, and while the idea of reinterring a grave may seem like a small detail, if you're a family, you know, there's probably one of the most difficult visits I ever made It's a fellow who lived in Gush Katif by the name of Yitzhak Chatuel. Maybe you heard his name. And he underwent a personal Holocaust. His family was, I think they were driving home. She was picking up the kids from school. And they were hit by terrorists. The car was riddled with bullets. And his wife and their three children were all murdered. In fact, the terrorists, in addition to filming this, did what's called vidui hariga. Vidui hariga means, just in case anyone's alive, they actually come over to the car and put a bullet in the head of every person in the car. So, you're a fellow. You work. You work the land. You live. Life is good. You're married. You have three children. And you wake up one morning and you have nothing. Your wife, your children, they're gone. Some of us maybe have a deeper comprehension of this through a relationship with the Holocaust, but for me, that's beyond comprehension. And he was incapable of letting go of the house where they lived. But people finally convinced him that he couldn't stay there. So he kept the apartment. And it was exactly as it was. All the kids' books, all the kids' clothes, his wife's clothes, the furniture, everything. You could walk into their house. And he couldn't bear to let go of his apartment because that's all that he had left of them. I mean, who will remember these three children? What did they succeed in accomplishing in this world? And then one fine day he gets a notice that no less than the Israeli army, and I'm not getting into the politics here, I'm just talking about the pain that this individual must feel. He's told that that last piece of them, that he's going to have to leave that behind. Not only will they have to leave that behind, but they have to destroy that house. So he has to watch as a bulldozer destroys that house. And then on Thursday, they have to dig up the graves of his wife and children and rebury them. And since, by the way, he doesn't yet know where he's going to live, because they haven't had a chance to work that out, he doesn't know where to rebury them. Because obviously he wants them buried somewhere where he'll be, but where will he be? And that little microcosm of pain is what the Jewish people in Israel went through this week. So there's a Mishnah that we traditionally read. It's from Ethics of the Fathers that we read every time we have a funeral. And it's in the beginning. It's very easy to find. It's the beginning of the third chapter of Ethics of the Fathers, Perkei Avot. And you can find it in the Siddur after the Mincha prayer on Shabbat afternoon. Akavya ben Mahalalel Omer. Akavya ben Mahalalel says, it's interesting that his name is Mahalel El, he who praises God. And the one who is known as the one who praises God, or the son of one who praises God, is the one who gives us a word of comfort and challenge at a funeral. That's a world of discussion in itself. Histakel b'shlosha dvarim ve'inata balidei avira. Look at three things, and you will not come to make mistakes in this world. Da me'ayin bata, know from where you've come. U'le'an ata olech, and where you're going. V'lifnei mi'ata tiditen din v'cheshbon. And before whom you will ultimately give din v'cheshbon, an accounting. Da me'ayin bata, you have to know where you come from. You know, it's interesting. We say at the beginning of the 18th benediction prayer of the Shemona Esrei, okay, Elokeinu ve'Elokei Avoteinu. Blessed are you, God, the God of our God, and the God of our fathers. It's an interesting question. If I could actually have a relationship with God, if I could actually believe that Hashem is so in my life, that He's Elokai, that He's my God, if I could be so connected to the people around me, and to the Jewish people, and maybe to the world, that I realize that this God is Elokeinu, He's all of our God, that would be amazing. That would be enough. Why do I have to add Ve'Elokei Avoteinu? That He's also the God of our forefathers. Because if you don't know where you come from on a certain level, you don't really know who you are. Whenever I meet people who are searching for who they are, it's almost always that they're struggling to understand where they're from. On a certain level, reconnecting to where I come from is reconnecting to who I am. And you have to know where you're going. You have to know where it's going to. If you really understood where you were going, if you're sitting in a business deal, And you have this opportunity to tell a fib and to make a buck. But you understand that at the end of the day, you're going to be in the ground, and what's really going to matter is the person you became and not the money that you made. You couldn't make that mistake. Do I know where I'm going? And I want you to know that this presents for us a tremendous challenge today. Because in Israel, and I believe in the Jewish people in the world, and I would even go so far as to say that this is a phenomenon that we find in peoples all over the world, we have two problems. We don't know where we come from. And you don't have to go to America. You don't have to go to Iowa. Every year, sort of as a comedy, which is really a Shakespearean tragedy, they interview people on the street round about different Jewish holidays. And I remember one year I was in the Jerusalem Post, and they were interviewing people about the story of Purim. You know? And the answers that people who were stopped came up with were mind-boggling. People had no idea what Purim was and where it came from and who it was. What the Hanukkah of the menorah story in Hanukkah was. Why we celebrate these things. Where did we leave at the Passover story? Now, if you ask the average Jew, where were we before the Passover story came along? Most people would say Egypt. What do you do when you have a kid who grew up in Israel, served in the Israeli army, and yet has no idea how to answer that question? That's just mind-boggling. We've forgotten where we come from. And by the way, nobody should interpret, because there's one of the things I love about Israelite, so many different types of people sitting around this, on this lawn, right? Is that, God forbid, nobody should feel that that should make you feel bad. You know, I'm not a big believer in Jewish guilt. That's a discussion maybe for over Shabbat. It should just make you feel challenged. We live in a generation where we have the opportunity to explore these things. So the first challenge is where I come from. The second challenge is where I'm going. Do I know where I'm going? And some of us have spoken about this before. If you ask the average Jew in Israel today, do you believe that we need a Jewish state? I believe most Jews will say yes. If you ask them why, I'm not sure most of them will have any idea. And I won't embarrass anybody here. Maybe you'll be ahead of the game because you heard Rabbi Aaron this morning. But it's a challenging question. So where are we going? Why do we need this? And then comes the third piece. Lifnei mi ata atid liten din v'cheshbon. Before whom, ultimately, will you give an accounting? Now, here's an interesting question. What is the difference between din and cheshbon? What does that mean? If one day you're going to be responsible to give an accounting, that's called a cheshbon. Din seems to be some form of a judgment. What's the difference between a din and a cheshbon? And why do I have to be concerned with both of them? So let me give you two perspectives on both of these questions. First, if our challenge, if our goal, is to figure out where we're coming from and where we're going, then that is ultimately why we need the state of Israel and the land of Israel. You know, sometimes there are questions, and I'm not a big believer in answers to questions. I think when a person has an answer, he thinks he's got it in a box, and he's done. I'm more interested in perspectives, so I can share with you where I'm at on this question, but I think everybody has to struggle with the answer to this question for themselves. But there are some questions you may not be able to verbalize a response, but you know what it is. If you were to ask me, I don't know, how did I know when I met my wife that she was the right person? I mean, that's a crazy question. I remember I used to run a yeshiva, and I could always tell when my guys, you know, had a good date, right? Because they'd walk around with that stupid expression on their face, and they'd be tripping over themselves, you know, banging into poles. I could usually tell the name of the girl that they just met because it was doodled all over the side of their notebooks, right? I could usually tell when someone just got dumped because they'd come in with that puppy dog look, you know? And one day there was a boy, one of these yeshiva guys, and he was going through this spiraling experience, right? He was on top of the world. He met the right one. He thinks she's it. He's so excited, you know, disappeared from yeshiva for days at a time. And then after about a month of this, you know, and I don't push, you know, I never used to push my guys, like, you know, you have to learn because you want to be there. And shows up to the base medrash, to the study hall one day, and he's just miserable. Like somebody just stepped on his life, right? So I walk over to him, how's it going, whatever, and he just looks like he's like about to fall apart. So we get into this whole discussion, and he thought she was it, and she's not it, and fine. And so finally at one point he says to me, you know, how did you know? How do you know when you find the right person? And he actually says to me, maybe there's something wrong with my list. A list. And I still think we're talking allegorically, you know, the list of who he's looking for. He pulls out a list. There's a list. So obviously you don't marry a list. How do you know? And sometimes you know that you know. In fact, I mean, I think of this every time we discuss this topic, but I know exactly when I knew that my wife was for me. I know exactly when it happened because we were sitting, it was a few days after I met her, and she looked at me and she said, I want you to know that I know we're going to get married, right? Absolutely. And then she said, I want you to know that you know that we're going to get married. And then she said, when you know that you know, let me know, right? And I didn't run. And that's how I knew. And I look back at that now, and I absolutely know that I must have been out of my mind. How did I know? That's ridiculous. I mean, I'm married now almost 16 years, thank God, and I'm just beginning to get to know her. I mean, it's amazing how you think you know a person, and then you get to know a whole new world of her. And anybody here who's dated someone, let alone married someone, knows that the idea that you could really know a person before you marry them is ridiculous. In fact, for anyone here who's contemplating a relationship, that's a discussion we can have Friday night after dinner on Shabbat. How do you know? It's not so complicated. You got to make it simple. But there's some things that you just know. And that type of knowledge is not empirical. It's called dat. It's inner knowledge. It's something that you can experience, but you can't always describe. It's like lunch. You'll go back and you'll tell people, it was great, we had a good time, and I'll know that the real reason you had a good time was because of lunch, because of the food. I mean, the classes are nice, and the areas, but the food. If you have good food, you have a good time. So personally, you know, that kind of food, that works for me. You give me, I don't even know what it's called. What's it called? You put it in the thing, and you wrap it around the stuff, and whatever. It's the thing and the stuff, right? You have that thing and that stuff, and it's just good. And imagine I'm trying to explain to someone this thing and that stuff, it's unbelievable. You can't, they have to eat it. You can't explain it to them. Can't explain it to them. There's some things that are an experience. Why is that? I remember we once had a student. You know, there's a Gemara. The Talmud says that every Jew has four amot, has four cubits in the land of Israel. And those four cubits are theirs. That box, that space. And I always thought this was allegorical. And maybe it is. Until I met this particular girl. We had a birthright group. And they come to Israel. And, you know, I mean, what a thirsty group of students. I mean, here's a group, they've never been to Israel before. And now somebody's paying for them to come. And they get to come to the old city of Jerusalem to hang out with Israelite for 10 days of studying, touring, and learning. It was unbelievable. You really have to be an idiot to mess that up. You could not give them a good time. There's this one girl, and she started out, you know, like this. You know, like there was this wall of energy. And no matter what we were doing, and I don't like to push people, everybody has to find their own path. So like, you know, we'd be jamming and, you know, we'd have like, you know, the muttles of the world, like sing-a-linging and ding-a-linging, you know, and Yaakov Doving and whatever. And just jamming away. You can't, you know, you're sitting at Saturday night, you're in the Jewish quarter, everybody's jamming, and people are into it, and she's like on the side. And okay, you know, is it, how's it going? Okay. You know, we go down to the Kotel on Friday night. Tens of thousands of Jews and people are dancing and singing. And she didn't want to even go down to the Kotel. She's like in the back like this. So we get to Tzfat. This is like the eighth day of the trip. We get to Tzfat. And we get to Tzfat and this girl gets off the bus. I never saw anything like this. She, like, her eyes are popping out of her sockets. She goes, what is this place? And we offered them, like, I was going to give them a tour of the old city of Tzfat, so they go to the artist colony. She found this group of, like, three or four guys wearing big white Super Bowl breast-level yarmulkes. My wife likes to call these the guys who have their feet firmly planted in the air, right? And she just sits down with them, and she starts singing with them. And they actually started playing a niggun that we had done in Israelite, for which she had stood like this. And she just starts singing with them. And 2-3 hours later, we finished our brief run through Tzfat, because this is a quick trip. And she wants to know what this place is, and can she stay there tonight? And I look at her like she's fallen off her gourd. You know, yeah, you're over 18. If you want to stay, you know, you can meet us back for whatever in the morning. So we called up Leave Note, which is an organization there, and they agreed to put her up. And she stayed overnight in Tzfat. Blew her mind. And she actually came back like 6 months later in the summer. And she went to Tzfat for 2 months to study. Still haven't figured it out. This girl just found her spot. And if I would have sat with this girl 6 months before, and I would have said to her, you need to come to Tzfat, and I would have tried to describe it to her, she would have said I was mad. But then she experienced it. I can describe a girl for a fellow. It doesn't make sense until you experience it. And that's piece number one of the land of Israel. There's an experience in Israel that can't be defined. And I think the reason that experience is so powerful is because we're reconnecting with where we came from. And the reason that God began it all there, and the reason that God allows us to come back there, and the reason that Avraham begins there, and the reason that every major story in Jewish history unfolds along the hills and the pathways of Judea in the land of Israel, is because that's where we connect to what we're doing here. Connecting to what we are meant to do in this world is not in a book. It's got to be in your heart. Very hard. And if it's true as an individual, it's even more true as a nation. Every nation has a mission in this world. Every nation has a purpose. And by the way, people make a mistake about this topic. They think that somehow the fact that we live and love and learn in the land of Israel, that we call ourselves the chosen people in the chosen land, that somehow means that we're better. That's not true. And some might argue with me, and I guess it's a legitimate argument. I don't believe that chosen means better. When we thank God for choosing us, chosen does not mean better. All my children are chosen. They're just chosen for different things. If I want one of my kids to be the babysitter tonight, that's not going to be Yair, because he just turned 7. I would choose Mayan. And now we're starting to be able to choose Yonatan. If I need someone to sit with me and to sing, that's Yonatan. He's unbelievable. Perfect pitch. Loves to sing. And if I want someone to draw, that's not Yonatan. That's Mayan. And each one of my children has different gifts. You put a box of Lego in front of Yair, he'll turn it into a computer. It's unbelievable. Everybody has their skills. We're chosen. We're all chosen for something. If God created every human being, if God created every nation, that's because every nation is meant to be here. They have a purpose. They have a mission. They're chosen for something. And if a nation is chosen for something, you can only be a nation if you have a land. You can only fulfill your mission in the place where you're meant to be. That's the meaning of the land of Israel. Which leads me to the last point. What is the third line of Akavya ben Mahalalel? Lifnei mi ata atid litein din v'cheshbon. Remember before whom you will give an accounting. What's the difference between din, justice, and cheshbon in accounting? So the Vilna Gaon suggests that din is the action that you've done, and cheshbon is what you could have been doing instead. In other words, one day we're going to bear responsibility not just for what we did, but what we didn't do. If I eat a cheeseburger, if I speak slander, it's not just that I'm going to be held accountable for speaking slander at the table. It's what I could have been speaking instead. Those are two different things. It's not just that I slandered another human being. It's that I could have been spreading love. I could have been making somebody feel special. I could have been sharing a word of Torah. Rav Avigdor Nevensohl, however, has a different perspective. And listen to this well. Din is the objective right or wrong of an action. But the cheshbon, the accounting, is how it fits with who you are. If you're asked to give tzedakah, so technically, halachically, there are instances you're obligated to give tzedakah, charity, and there are instances that you're not. But there's another factor that factors into this. And that's the cheshbon. The cheshbon is not about the objective right or wrong of what you did. It's about the objective reality of who you are. You know, if a very stingy person is always stingy, he's a penny pincher. He just can't bear the thought that his wife bought double-ply toilet paper because it's going to cost them 0.8 cents. So I might say he's a little off, but that's who he is. So if a beggar comes to the door and asks him for a donation and he can't bear to part with his money, at least he's consistent with who he is. But if a person spends all of his money vacationing around the world, and he loves to go out and eat, and he buys every toy you can imagine, and a beggar comes to his door, and he can't even give him $10, then there's something really wrong. And by the way, it may be, you know, you're not always obligated to give tzedakah. It may be that you've done nothing wrong technically in the world of din. But in the cheshbon of things, in the accounting, you're off. And I want you to know that if this is true as individuals, it's also true as nations, and specifically generations. We live in an incredible time. And there's a big debate today about the din of Eretz Israel. Are we obligated to live in Israel? And, you know, there are some who believe that there's a Talmudic discussion in the Tractate of Ketubot that we were sworn as a people not to rebel against the nations, not to go to Israel. And I don't agree with that. I think it's actually a mistake. But if you believe that and you're consistent with that, and you think that you shouldn't go to Israel, whatever it might be, or you think that you can't teach your children Torah in Israel like you can in America, you can imagine my opinion, but at least that's your opinion, you're consistent. If you have no idea where Israel is on the map, if you've never even thought about Israel, if you don't even know what it means to be Jewish, so then I think you're missing something valuable and beautiful, and I might share with you what that is, but at least you're consistent. But what if you believe deeply in the state of Israel? What if you support the federations that support Israel? What if you think that the state of Israel is the last bastion of Judaism in the world? Well, then you've got a problem. I can't tell, and I don't judge, by the way, any individual for what they do. It's a big mistake that we make. Judging, life is too short to judge. There are lots of reasons that people don't live in Israel. Family, health in the family, business, whatever it might be. But if you ask me why I moved to Israel, I did a cheshbon. I decided I wake up every morning and I pray three times a day that God should bring us back to Jerusalem. Maybe it's time I pay the $9.99 and go. And I want you to know, I did not go to Israel with the intent of living there. I just wanted to experience it. And I got a lot more than I bargained for, because I fell in love. And I couldn't explain to you why I fell in love. And I couldn't define it. It's an experience. So I would end with this thing. We're going to talk more over Shabbat and on Sunday. What's going on in Israel, the implications. Every one of us has to do a cheshbon. We have to do an accounting with ourselves. For some of us, that means we have to struggle with whether we should be in Israel. For some of us, that means we have to do an accounting of whether we should visit Israel. For some of us, maybe it just means we should do an accounting of whether we should be supporting Israel. But we all have to struggle with where Israel sits in our heart. And if you ask me why Israel is so critical, it's because the secret to figuring out who we are and where we're going is hidden in the land of Israel. And I bless everyone here and all of us that we should find the strength, that we should so merit to succeed in going there to find that, all of us as a people, soon. Shabbat Shalom.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.